Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and we got a full house today.
We most certainly do. You know, we strolled in after lunch. The lobby was full. We knew we were going to be having a chance to visit with a lot of folks on this segment. And it's going to be a fun one because we've got some new friends here and we're catching up with some old. A little bit later in the program, we're going to visit with Dirk Ebener. You know, he's the mastermind behind the Kids Business Expo. And then, I don't know, the queen of crowdfunding and funding in general has got a lot to catch us up on. We're going to get a chance to talk with Dara Albright. And then my good friend Howard Medoff, we're going to visit with him. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the grand poobah, the founder, the chief mohaw over there at the ROI shop. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Mr. Farber, how you doing, man?
Good. How are you doing, Stone? Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you. So we met at some powwow last week or so, what the Sales Loft guys were doing, right?
Sales Loft, yeah. They had their first conference called Rainmaker, so that's how we met.
And you guys over at the ROI shop, what are you doing for folks?
Well, a little background on me. I've been in software sales for over 16 years, working for about five or six different types of companies and different types of offering. And one thing I always struggled with, as well as my colleagues, was proving value and building the business case, creating that ROI. And it was a real void in the marketplace. Companies really
didn't care about ROI?
They do, but it seems to be an afterthought. They don't approach it the right way, yeah.
Really?
Yep.
So what do they think they're doing in business? It's not getting a return on their investment.
Well, a lot of times they think with just a powerful demonstration, that should win them over. And some of the things that they build in-house is an Excel spreadsheet that they give to the field to go out and use. But typically it's the person who's best in Excel at that company will put it together. And it's a nightmare. And reps don't really use it. So it's kind of gone to the wayside. And reps don't build the business case with the prospect the way they should. And that's really why we started this company.
And then so your product and or service helps the salesperson demonstrate their ROI?
Yes. What they would do is it's an online tool. You would build it in collaboration with your prospect. You'd go in there, you sit down with them or do it via WebEx. You go through the numbers you have to ask, and then the system will generate, you know, the different areas of savings that an organization could provide in a more compelling way using videos, using pop-ups, creating a professional PDF leave behind. So it's just more customer facing than what's out there today.
And then, so right now they're using some kind of random Excel spreadsheet that doesn't look sexy, that just kind of looks plain, and they're not even using that effectively?
Exactly. It's outdated, it's error prone, it's not customer facing. And it typically brings up more questions than answers, and that's why I always did, my colleagues always did. We shied away from it.
So you wouldn't use any type of spreadsheet?
No.
So you just kind of walk them through scenarios then, I guess, the customer? How would you deal with the ROI?
Soft shoe.
Soft shoe? Little
right? Yeah, you actually didn't bring it up.
Don't bring it up.
No,
that's an interesting strategy. Don't bring it up strategy.
So we're going to visit with him in a little while and you know, have a dedicated segment as we visit with Howard Medoff. But I want you to clock in on this. I mean, you have how many years sales development executive? How important is it in your experience to be equipped to help your prospective client calculate potential ROI? I mean, it's a big deal, right?
It's a huge deal. If you can't demonstrate value, then you're really at a loss from building that trusted advisor relationship. People need to see that you have value to bring in terms of an important story. You can demonstrate it with a right business case, and more importantly, that you can show ROI not only that's relevant to them, but hopefully success stories you can mimic that you've already accomplished and can share with them as well.
All right, so you're in Farber's camp. You think this is probably a good thing? I got to ask about the questions. So You've already figured out the questions, or when I tell you about my business, you sit down and help me, and you say, Stone, if what you're doing is helping your selling businesses on underwriting shows, for example, or sponsoring something, you should be asking these five or six questions. How does that piece work?
Well, most organizations have a decent idea on the value drivers, you know, where they save or make a company money.
There you go.
So I would sit down with you, say, what are the areas of savings and what are the questions you need to ask to calculate those savings? And then through my experience, and you may have an Excel environment already, we would go ahead and build something. And that's the implementation part. It's very collaborative, and we'd get something that you feel comfortable with, your reps feel comfortable with, and then you roll it out to the field. And then it's always living and breathing and changing. So we'll never get it 100% right the first time. But as we get feedback from the field, we'll go ahead and adjust it and make it better.
So now when you're first rolling it out, so it's kind of, like you said, it's kind of iterative. Like you guys make a best guess of what it should include. And then do you sometimes go out in the field with the person to see what it's like in real life? Or you just hand it off to them and they take it out and then maybe kind of walk some prospects through. And then they're like, you know what? They love this. They didn't like this.
Yeah, that's typically what happens. They'll roll it out to the field. I always like for them to offer some incentive for the rep who uses it the most over the next 3 months. It gets right. them all using it. They'll see it's a competitive advantage, and it will start to change the way they sell. But really, they'll get feedback. You know, management team could only help so much. They're not out there in the field asking the questions.
Right.
So we put it together based on what they think. But ultimately, if we can get reps input, that's what really makes the tool better.
Now, do you use it when you're selling your own stuff?
Absolutely.
he eats his own cookie,
I have my own. Yeah, I got to eat my own dog food. So, and it's always changing. I've changed my ROI at least 4 or 5 times even over the past year because some things work, some things didn't. I always find myself getting stumped or not conveying the message the right way. So right. I keep making changes.
And onboarding salespeople, is it helpful to onboarding anybody in the organization, is it helpful to walk them through that same process just like you would if you were going to sell them something?
Absolutely, because ROI has been such a disconnect and people do it so poorly and reps don't use it, managers don't do it. So almost in my selling process, I have to do the best practices by setting up the meeting, sending out the questions ahead of time, just walking them through the process that their reps should be doing. So they can envision how it would work for them.
Now, does this work better for companies that are kind of value? They're selling more value than they are like a commodity where, you know, you're trying to sell something for 5 cents cheaper as opposed to like more of a consultant where I'm going to provide X number of dollars of value. So I'm not selling you like kind of a cost of goods. I'm selling you kind of a bigger package, or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. You know, I'm focusing on the software industry because that's my background. That's the language I know how to talk. There's some hard dollar costs. There's a lot of soft dollar costs. So that's a little harder to prove. So we built in ways to help prove that more effectively. Manufacturing environments is a great arena. We're not yet, I don't know that arena that well, but we're right. starting to branch into it. And that's a lot easier because most of manufacturing is hard dollar cost when you can create more widgets, reduce scrap, right. reduce errors, those types of things.
But so anything that's easily measurable fits nicely into your model.
Yes, very. Yep, exactly.
Now, Dirk and Dara, who you'll learn about later, they both do events. Like, would sponsorships fit into that model as well?
You know,
always say yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was gonna say, I'm sure you're familiar with Dreamforce and Salesforce and their big event. Right on, you know, should I go to this event? They have a mini website calculator that says, here's what you could expect. So, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Love that. That was the right answer.
Thank you.
Well, I gotta tell you, I would have loved to have had something like this in a former life when I was selling training and consulting. And for a couple of reasons. One, I think it would streamline the process and give us all some common nomenclature and some things to talk about. But also, often I would be selling a fairly high dollar service into mm-hmm. a system, and my champion was 110% on board. They understood completely what we were doing, why we were doing, the value of it, but they didn't have enough authority, you know, to buy a box of pencils. They were just so they had that intellectual power. They knew the stuff. They were subject matter experts. So if I could equip them with something like this, so that they could go to their executives and would be willing to have that conversation with their execs. Do you see that in the software arena as well?
Yeah, that's a huge problem because you could work with a champion all day long, and then they have to present your business case or why they should buy something to the CFO. And they just do a terrible job. And companies do a horrible job of equipping their champions with any types of selling tools. I one time was sitting down with a CFO, and I was asking him about this. And he said, yeah, about a quarter, 20, in one business quarter, about 20 people will come to them and say, hey, we should go move forward with this project.
Mm-hmm.
He would ask a couple questions. 10 of them wouldn't know how to answer it. They'd walk out with their tail between their legs. And then the other 10, he'd say, what's the business case? 7 out of those 10 did a horrible job of presenting the business case. So they didn't get the money. The 3 that actually did a good job, those were the 3 he gave money to and considerable thought about the project. So equipping that champion is really important.
Now, do you have any data on if this tool like speeds up the sales cycle?
It does. We haven't captured all the data. We're a relatively new company. We've been in business here for about 2 years. I might get in trouble for saying this company's name on the radio, so I won't. But we just signed our
biggest... What does it rhyme with? No, I'm kidding.
I was thinking. Then a bad thing came in my head. I said, I can't say that. Well, what happened is they did an extensive pilot. They had over 30 users. They tried it for 4 months. And what they came back with is they actually closed 55% of the deals the tool was used in. Now, I'm not saying we're the direct cause of it, but what was reported back that, A, it initiated the critical financial discussions earlier on. B, reps can quickly figure out who was interested and who was not. Because if a prospect is not willing to go through that exercise, how great of a prospect are they?
Right.
So they were able to spend their time more wisely. And with our tool, you can see, are they looking at it? Are they not? So once again, it's also a great way of tracking the prospect's interest level. But we hope to get those types of analytics.
Now, when you're working with a new client, is this something that's a freemium model or do you have to buy it right away? How does the purchase work?
You know, there's a one-time setup, and that really depends on the complexity of the ROI, how many ROIs you need, because you may need different ones based on vertical or company right. size or product. So it's a little bit more of a scope to figure out that. And then it's a price per user. It's a subscription model. And like Costco, the more you buy, the less it is. So depending on how many sales reps would use the tool, that's what we price it on. And we're also seeing an extension of this tool to the customer success team. So what they're using is making it mandatory to use the tool in the front end. And then once they become a customer, they're transitioning it over to the customer success team or an account manager and making sure... You know, what was promised to them in the sales cycle is actually something they're achieving. So it's reducing churn, reducing discount. And
because sometimes it's important to let your client know how much value you're providing on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Dara, are you buying into this? What do you think? Yeah, you on board with this?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's great. And, you know, it when you also talk about companies that are now raising capital through crowd finance, I mean, you know, they need new ways of actually going out there and producing that ROI. And it's really all boils down to. It's, you know, company could always have a great story. A story means nothing if you do not have that ROI. Mm-hmm. So that's great stuff.
No, I think it's fantastic, man. Keep up the good work. All right, where can our listeners go more if they want to have a substantive conversation with you or someone on your team? Where can they go to listen
to
learn more?
Just go to theroishop.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, listen, man, hang out with us while we visit with our next guest.
Absolutely.
All right. Please join me in welcoming back to the studio, no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, we have with us Dara Albright, and she is the president with Dara Albright Events and Neck Deep and funding and all that cool stuff. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me again. I always have a great time doing this show.
So is crowd finance still a thing or did that go away?
It has not gone away. In fact, the industry has really progressed dramatically. I think when I was here the last time, it might have been right after the passage of the Jobs
right.
Act. So now we've seen, you know, a tremendous amount of development within the industry. You know, I look at it like this because there is a lot of misconception out there as to what crowd finance actually is. And, you know, I usually tell people what it is not. You know, there was a really funny article that appeared probably about a year and a half ago in the New Yorker magazine. And it was an article that depicted these two panhandlers standing on a street corner, you know, begging for money. And the caption read, "Remember, you know, we're not begging, we're crowdfunding." And, you know, it's a great cartoon. You know, you always giggle when you see it. But the truth is, that's really not what crowd finance actually is. And what crowd finance, all it really is instead, it's really it, what it is instead of capital coming to fund projects or businesses, instead of the capital coming from, you know, government entities or large financial institutions, it's basically coming from we the people. And crowd finance is basically, you know, is basically what built America. I mean, it was, you know, providing its citizens the freedom to invest in the ingenuity and invention of its fellow citizens. And that's, you know, that's what brought us, you know, incredible innovations and inventions that changed the world. And that's what brought us products that changed the world. And that's what brought people profits, you know, and that's what grew America.
Now, it in my understanding, it evolved. It's evolved from the point of the Kickstarters, where you could kind of invest in some creative project or a T-shirt or movie or things like that, to now where businesses are actually using it as a way to finance their growth in their business.
Exactly. So, what started off as what everyone knows as the Kickstarter model, or you know, pre-purchasing products, when the passage of the Jobs Act in April of 2012, now they what was introduced through legislation was the ability to now obtain a security in exchange for that for that investment or for that funding. So, and that security could be either, you know, an equity security, could be, you know, could be bond, what have you. And there are different components of the Jobs Act. So the actual, what we call unaccredited crowdfunding, which means that you could go out to the masses and basically be able to raise capital, you know, through the masses, people that you don't know, that's under Title III of the Jobs Act. And while it was passed and signed into law April 2012, it's still the SEC. It's not. It won't become effective until the SEC basically establishes the final rules. And we're not there
yet.
And
we're moving in government speed, so
yeah. So, you know, you see, you might want to figure probably never, you know, or you're
but Georgia has some, if you are, a resident or your business is in Georgia,
or if you like grits, what's the criteria?
Well, Georgia, first of all, this is the greatest state in the union.
When it comes to this, right?
It is.
This is a leader.
This is. Georgia has been really on the forefront of the crowdfunding movement. There is an exemption that called Rule 147 that allows for an intrastate offering. So, meaning if a company is domiciled within that state and they go out to investors within that state, they could go under Rule 147, which means they would be governed by the state rules. And Georgia was the second state in the nation to come out and enact actual crowdfunding legislation. It's called the Invest Georgia Exemption, or IGE. And it's you know, I would say the federal crowdfunding should be modeled after Georgia, because I think that's how great it is.
Right. And the federal, it sounds like to me, the federal aspires to be like the Georgia, but there's just a lot of bureaucracy to get that done, right?
There's a lot.
Aspires. But have businesses been funded in Georgia using that?
Yeah, the first there's a portal in Georgia called Spark Market.
Mm-hmm. We know those guys.
Yeah, they're great. They're great guys. They facilitated the actual first, the first unaccredited crowdfunding capital raise in the country was really facilitated by them through using the IGE, and that was a company called Bohemian Guitars, local company.
Yeah.
Very cool company. Oh, they make the guitars out of the vintage oil cans, and so that was the first one. And I, you know, it's going to take a while. I mean, I think to really get this off the ground, I mean, there really has to be a lot of education and awareness out there. And that's really what I feel like, you know, our role in this whole thing is doing.
Okay, okay. So while Lee looks up the word domiciled, Mike, do you need money? You already have money. If you did need money, would you consider this?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because we bootstrapped the whole thing. We haven't taken any outside money.
Right,
we've
okay.
started just off of the savings, two guys working out of their garage. So it was always an area, do I want to build faster and give something away or build slow and keep it all? So it's always a question I still struggle with.
We should definitely talk.
Right. So now, okay, that's interesting. You mentioned you should talk. Like, what would you talk about? Like, what is your service that you would offer?
Well, I mean, what I do if I, you know, a lot of companies approach me that are looking for capital. I mean, what I usually do is I understand exactly what the company is doing, who your market is. I'm actually writing a book right now on ways to utilize crowd finance throughout your capital raise, because what I see it actually happening is that we're going to see an entirely new path of capital formation, where it used to be if you were looking to raise capital, you know, you would maybe bootstrap it, you go to your credit cards, maybe, you know, friends and family.
Right. Friends, family, and fools. Right.
Right.
early adopters.
Yeah.
Find some angel investors, you know, maybe you reach out to some venture capitalists and hope that maybe somewhere down the road there's either, you know, you're acquired or, you know, you do an IPO. I mean,
right,
that
but there
was
has to be some exit in order to for the exactly. venture capitalists or these larger private equity firms. They're not doing this just because they're nice guys, right?
Right, that's exactly right. That's what's great. That's what I love about crowdfunders, because they are nice guys.
Right, and
know?
They could be because, yeah. I mean, we've talked to some people, like from a real estate standpoint, there's some crowdfunding, like this peer-to-peer lending, right, mm-hmm. with real estate, where they invest in the neighborhood and then they get the neighbors to invest in the neighborhood to put a mixed use development there that benefits the neighborhood.
Right. And that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think with crowdfunders, they have a different mindset than
right.
than,
they're in for the long haul.
Yeah, they are genuinely interested in, like, if it's a community project, they're interested in the community, they live in the community, or, you know, if it's a company that has, you know, built some kind of widget, you know, they're genuinely interested in that widget. It's
right.
the Peter Lynch method of investing.
Right.
That's
invest
what it boils
in what you
down.
Know and like.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So now, can you talk a little bit about this peer-to-peer investment? Because that's not just for a small investor. This could be for a larger investor as well, right?
Sure. So the P2P space, which is really the debt side of crowd finance, P2P is peer-to-peer lending. Since we're talking about corporate finance, it's also, we sometimes refer to it as P2B or peer-to-business.
Right.
So it's basically a way for businesses to obtain a loan, whether it be from their local community. That falls under the Jobs Act.
Okay.
For peer-to-business. But P2P, peer-to-peer, is in the consumer debt space. So if you wanted to start a business, maybe, you could go to take money off of your credit card. I mean,
right.
it's an alternative for that. So P2P is really consumer finance. What we've really seen are a lot of people that have mostly been, going and taking their, you know, credit cards and
right with like interest rates that are like
yeah exactly and
insane,
refinancing
right.
their credit card debt. So that's what we've seen in the P2P space. But what has exploded, and this really started in about 2006. The industry for P2P exploded. When it started off as people lending directly to other people through portals on the internet, such as a lending club or Prosper.
Are these those micro loans or?
Well,
is that different?
It's different. These are basically people that are investing directly into other people. Through one of these portals, and you don't know exactly who it is that you're investing with. You know a lot about that particular borrower, but you don't know exactly you know who that particular borrower
is. And micro is relative, I would think, Lee. It might
well,
be
they
micro
have the
to
things
you.
Like Kiva, right, where you can lend
that.
And
right.
buy
I'm
someone a cow, right,
right.
Like in Colombia,
right. It's a little bit different, but I mean, I think it falls under the very
premise.
Same umbrella. But I mean, Lending Club grew so big. I mean, they just went public a couple of weeks ago. It was the second biggest IPO of 2014. They
wow.
raised $1 billion. So, I mean, the marketplace is exploding. And now what we're seeing is there's so much demand for these loans because people, on average, the lenders are, you know, averaging about 8 to 10, sometimes even more, percent a year. Investing in this space, so they're looking at it more as a, you know, a fixed income alternative, you know, beating right. the banks. So, you know, now the problem is that there aren't enough borrowers. There are too many. There basically is too much money changing too few good borrowers, and the
so industry, they need more borrowers.
They need more borrowers.
So if you have a business that needs money, that this is something you should at least explore.
Definitely. I mean, I think what you're going to see is the corporate side of the market start to come, you know, eat up some of that supply coming into it, especially as the rules change.
What is the size of the loan that you can get through this?
They all vary. I mean, you have to look at all the different platforms. In my book, I'm outlining all the different platforms, especially for businesses.
Is it like 5,000 or could it be a million?
No, it depends. I mean, it could go up to a couple of 100,000. It depends really. I mean, they're not, million is a little bit on the high side. There's a great company locally here, Cabbage.
An example of one of these platforms that facilitates a little bit different.
I wouldn't categorize them as actually P2P because they're institutional money, so it's a little bit of a different model. But for businesses that are, you know, maybe looking for credit lines,
right?
You know, it's an opportunity.
And so that you would go to them rather than a bank, that would be easier, or less paperwork, or less hassle.
You know, banks aren't even lending, so right. you know, I think we're really going to see definitely a transformation of even the whole community banking industry.
I think Dirk, I mean, you've got this Kids Expo thing. Right. It looks like it's going to take off. If it does, then they're going to want you in a bunch of cities. You may need a line of credit. You don't need millions, but a couple hundred thousand might be helpful.
Absolutely,
right?
Correct. And it's not only this. It's not only the expo itself, the concept of it. It's also the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the young entrepreneurs that are coming through. They are coming up with their own business ideas that have really worked hard. And they are at that point where their product really could make the market.
Right, and they need capital.
But they don't have the capital.
Right.
Because their parents or someone in their family doesn't have that.
See, and I would, I mean, I'm no big-time investor, but I would set aside some money for that in a New York minute. If there was some sort of pool or platform where I could invest in a few kids from your expo after I saw what they're...
Yeah.
I'd be all over that.
That's great. I love that. I'm looking forward to learning more about that.
Yeah.
So now, how can this crowd finance like help this local mom and pop, you know, the guy with the coffee shop?
Yeah, well, those are the guys that you know, have really been struggling the most because they're the ones that really don't have the ability to access capital, you know, as you know, compared to like a high tech, you know, kind of
right,
a company.
A venture capitalist, like, yeah, hey, there's a hockey stick at the end of this.
Right.
So, oh, I mean, yeah.
Right. So, you know, there are lots of ways. It would depend, you know, really what the particular company, their industry, their market. But, I mean, they could feel free to reach out anytime. Check out my website, daraalbright.com, and reach out to me. I'm always happy to just kind of point people in the right direction and you know, give some ideas. Once I hear a little bit about what their particular business is, say, okay, you know, this might be the best path for you to take or the best platform to pursue. So,
well, I'm excited. This February 26th event.
Yeah, what do you got going on in Florida?
Yeah, very excited about it. It's the small cap alternative financing revolution event. It's a cocktail event that we're doing in Boca Raton. So, for anyone looking for some heat and some warm weather, but it'll be great because we actually have We have really a lot of recognized leaders from the industry, both on the equity and the debt side.
Equity, bam.
That was good.
Somebody get that .com of that really fast.
So we've got great speakers. We've got Dave Wield, who former vice chairman of NASDAQ, and you know, he's doing some great things, and he's like known as the father of the crowdfunding movement. He's done exceptional work. A lot of these laws within the Jobs Act were based on his work. We've got, you know, amazing companies in the peer to business lending space. We've got OnDeck, who recently did a very high profile IPO as well. Orchard Platform. We have Jason Jones, who's a founder of Lend Academy Investments. They're, you know, one of the leaders in the P2P and online lending space, doing some incredible things. It's going to be a great event. We're going to be talking a lot about Reg A, which is another exemption, a part of the Jobs Act that I think is really going to be, really, when it comes down to it, is going to be what really the unaccredited crowdfunding model is going to be based on. I think Reg A is going to be a real viable alternative for raising capital through crowdfunding. We've got leaders in the space, Sam Guzik, who is one of the leading attorneys in the space. And just we've got a company that did its first Reg A offering, raised $5 million last year, and through Reg A, and they're going to be there with their bankers talking about how they structured it. So it's going to be a really great event.
Now, your organization is Dare Albright Events. So you're doing events all over the place now?
Yeah, events. I've actually really the last couple of months I've been focusing on the book. So I that was the biggest undertaking. I never knew what really goes into writing a book. So
maybe you could crowdsource it.
That's right.
Have everybody write a page.
Right. With unaccredited writers.
Well, I would love to do that, except a lot of it is my personal journey with this whole crowd finance. So, but it's going to be, I'm so proud of it. I really am. And I've read it to a couple of people, some sections. And they even got teary-eyed. So you think about, a book about finance that actually makes people emotionally.
Wow.
So what
is the timing on that?
It'll be sometime in 2015.
Cool. Yeah. So when you get that done, please come back.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll put you on this show or audio dust jacket, and we'll do a full blown interview on that.
That's love it. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
On that.
Thanks.
Coordinates one more time. Website.
DaraAlbright.com. And feel free to reach out anytime.
Well, it's always a pleasure having you in the studio. Thanks. You going to hang with us while we visit? Yeah,
definitely. I was going to sing "God Bless America" when I got into the whole crowd, But okay.
Well, we'll probably come back to you because Howard Medoff, who we're going to have as we wrap the show in a little bit, is kind of emerging from startup world, and I'm sure he would appreciate learning more and talking more about some of the oxygen that one can gather from the atmosphere if they tap into some of these resources.
Love
right?
It. Mm-hmm.
All right, good. All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio this afternoon, we have with us the CEO of Kids Business Expo, Mr. Dirk Ebener. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. But what, 5 days away?
Five days away.
So we'll see.
It seems like you've lost a lot of weight.
I have, actually. A lot of sleep, too. You
know? And especially now is the home
hair's
stretch.
Gray, yeah.
That's right.
So talk a little bit about the Kids Business Expo. How'd you get the idea? And
well, it's one of those moments when you have a family talk. And that family talk actually happened on the way to school for our 12-year-old daughter, Kaylin. And we were just watching over the weekend the typical, entrepreneurship radio shows and TV shows. And so Kaylin said on the way to school, she said, "Dad, you've been in the event and expo business for so long. Why don't you launch an expo for kids, where kids can learn about entrepreneurship and how to launch a business?" And I turned around, dropped her off, turned around, and started drawing it up. And a couple of months later, we're at Kids Business Expo coming up this Saturday.
And then what can a person attending expect to see there?
It's a wide spectrum of things. Our mission, our idea really is to provide kids in the age group 10 to 18 with a platform where they can really get into the idea, get that networking and that spark of interest started, where they can understand what it takes to launch a business. Because there are so many kids out there that have an idea, that have a vision, but they don't have that initial step, that launch into it. And so Kids Business Expo is a full-day event at the Galleria coming up this Saturday, the 7th. We are starting with Marcus Lemonis, the keynote speaker. He has a CNBC TV show called The Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after this, we have five young entrepreneurs on stage for a panel discussion.
And these are local, or they're from all over the
country? They're from all over. We have actually some from Florida. Attending or on the panel?
On the panel.
On the panel, it's all local. We have all local here.
So those are kids that have existing businesses?
Exactly, yeah. One of them has a business called Little Ice Cream Dude. Bo is out of Athens. It's amazing. He's 10 years old. You know, he's all over the business platform. Started his own business, has the support from his family. We're going all the way up to having people who have actually been on the Shark Tank.
Wow.
And they will talk about it. So that's the second segment of it. And then we'll have a networking break, and then we'll venture right into the business expo.
And then in the business expo, there's people with booths and tables?
Yes. We have about 90 booths on the floor, which is not bad for a startup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we have existing businesses and startup businesses launched by kids. So the combination right there is that we feel that businesses have a vested interest in bringing these new entrepreneurs on in order to discuss their opportunities to match the businesses. And then at the same time, we have groups like Junior Achievement, for example, that will bring a pavilion in where companies within that Junior Achievement program will launch their businesses and present it to the audience right at Kids Business Expo.
So now this was the first event of its kind, right?
It is the first. It's the first. And I checked the numbers this morning because I thought it might be asked about it. So,
what are the numbers, Dirt?
Thank you for the question.
You didn't think I was awake.
I know. We're right above 400 or 500 pre-registered.
Wow.
We have 21 states participating.
So was that surprising to get so much interest from people out of state?
It really absolutely has thrown me. It's something when you sort of start your business, as we all know, you have a dream, you have this vision, and then all of a sudden it's taken off. And it's great to see that kids will have a platform for learning about entrepreneurship and business.
So I think the tipping point was when they found out that Rich Casanova and Lee Cantor would be broadcasting live from the Expo Floor. That's true, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. You guys jumped right on. I mean, I can remember. I was here.
Well, we were early on.
You were right on.
As soon as you told us about it, we said we were
said yes, right?
I know. I remember that very well.
We have a soft spot for kid on.
We do. We really do.
I love this. I really do. I mean, I think it's so important, you know, to really get that entrepreneurial spirit into the youth.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to bring back America. And
right. I agree 100%. I think that that's one of the disservices that school and colleges, that they don't emphasize enough the entrepreneur, the choose-yourself path, that everything is geared to you getting a job somewhere else.
Right.
Correct.
There should be whole tracks of you making something happen on your own.
The other part I believe is very important is that we teach kids as early as possible that there is opportunity out there. And we have, you know, another event which has co-located with us, Kids Are Heroes, and they're focusing on the social side of entrepreneurship. So when somebody wants to really just start with a social entrepreneurship program, they can really learn from that segment and also come in and see the business expo. And what we have also decided is not only have an expo, but also offer workshops. So kids can go into workshops with their parents. And I feel it's so important that there's a vested interest by the adult, by the parent, or someone in their environment that really pushes them and helps them to understand it's okay to launch this and find out how it really turns out.
Right. And that in those workshops, that's where you'll cover things like financial stuff, business plan, things like that.
Correct. Yeah.
ROI, right?
ROI. Farmer,
you should be teaching one of these things.
One of the workshops will be about the Shark Tank experience that one of our presenters had. And then the other one is very important, I believe, is to learn very early on how to network effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that it takes to get this 30, 60-second pitch out about your company?
Right.
Because you never know who you meet. You right. never know who is in the elevator next to you. And if you're not prepared for that, you're, you know, stumbling over your own words. That helps to learn how to really get into this.
So now, after this event, do you have plans to do it again, or what's going to happen after?
It's really right now geared towards becoming an annual here in Metro Atlanta, but there is attention from outside. There are some cities and some other areas that have expressed an interest. Word is that they are coming to actually take a look at it.
To check you out?
To check me out. I've been in the trade show business for like 20 years. So
right. Don't they all know you already?
Well, I don't know about that, but you know, it would be great to have some people coming in for that.
All right, and so hours on this thing again?
It starts at 9 o'clock with, actually, the registration starts at 8 o'clock. So if you want to come in, you want to register early, walk on, you can do that at 8 o'clock, from 8 about 8, 9 o'clock. And then at 9:30, Marcus Lemonis will be on stage for the keynote, and it will end at 6 p.m.
All right, so probably a little bit late in the game for sponsorship at this point, but they can line up for the next one, or you'll take anybody's call and have a conversation.
You know what? Right now, we're all entrepreneurs, you know? Every dollar helps, and we definitely are, you know, if somebody comes in and says, hey, here's a sponsorship, I really want to do that because I feel very passionate about kids, give me a call.
They can sponsor the back of Dirk's jacket. Or like, Lee, you'll do a live read for him on the radio show or something, right? No, that is fantastic. We'll keep up the good work.
Thank you.
We are looking forward to participating and following you throughout. And I am so excited.
Well, I can't wait
to do this in other cities.
That's right. We are looking at it.
So definitely we're going to follow along.
I hope you do.
You can't get rid of us that easy. Don't worry.
Hey, listen, stay with us. We got one more guest this afternoon. Right. All right. Next up, and bringing it all home for us here on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Howard Medoff. Howard, this must be like being a kid in a candy store, because you have all these entrepreneurs. They've got so much going, and with your background and experience in sales and marketing, you must. I know you stay busy as a participant on an advisory board. You consult to organizations on their sales and marketing. What's going on in that world, man? What kind of things are changing and evolving in sales and marketing?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges, Stone, is to be compelling. You know, just like Dirk talked about, you know, kids learning how to do an elevator pitch and knowing how to get their message out there, you have to be compelling and you have to be able to really, in that first 30 seconds of a conversation, even a telephone conversation, make something stick.
Yeah, and people don't suffer very long. They want you to get to the point in a hurry, right?
Everyone's busy. So you got to be direct to the point. And, you know, with social media, smartphones, email, voicemail, texting, there's such a plethora of way to reach prospective clients. But I think that's absolutely critical, is that not only are you compelling, but one of the things that I would say when there's a pitfall of what some folks that are new in the sales world is you've got to go after your objective of learning about what the client's needs are. It sounds like sales 101, but it's really much more than that, because it's easy to get hung up about wanting to pitch your own product and service and all your features and your functionality, and aren't we grand?
Well, it's time-consuming to go find out about the prospect before you start selling, isn't it?
Well, you got to do your research, right?
Then you get these ROI guys wanting you to answer all kinds of silly questions.
That's why Dara's writing a book. Before you get money, you got to go to her book. But, you know, I just think one of the things that people are guilty of, even in conversational and networking, is you got to ask the questions. You got to sit there and really ask pointed questions and listen and ask questions again. I call it the QLQ method, you know, be able to really segue into what people's needs are, because that's the only way you're going to build that slow process of becoming a trusted advisor. And that's the ultimate for any salesperson. No matter what we're doing, if we're not perceived as a trusted advisor, then we haven't earned the right to maintain a business relationship.
Now, what are some of those questions that a salesperson should be asking?
I think the most important thing is the open-ended questions of what's driving their needs, what keeps them up at night, what is really, you know, people always talk about value, okay? Well, it's very hard to define value, but there's two ways to define value. The first is to ask, of course, the obvious, what's the business value? If I have a solution or service that I think might be useful to you, what would it mean to them to be successful with that solution or service? That's obvious. The hidden agenda is the personal value. And until you develop a relationship as a trusted advisor, you have to understand from that individual prospect what's important to them on a very personal level. Would their job, for example, Lee, be at risk if they invested hundreds of thousands of dollars with your solution or service and it's not successful? Are they on the line for that personally? Or would an unsuccessful implementation where they can't show ROI, where we need Mike to come in board, right? If they can't show ROI, will that put them in, you know, suck and win, so to speak? And so I think it's so, so important to understand, again, what is going to be of value on a personal level to that purchaser or prospect.
Now, sometimes when you're having a sales conversation with someone, there's like kind of they use delay tactics or they're like ignoring you. Do you have any suggestions on how to kind of speed up that process?
Well, I think there's a lot of creative ways you got to reach clients. You know, you've got to understand what they're most comfortable with in terms of being contacted. So that's, again, in the QLQ session, how do you prefer? What's your preferred method of contact? Some people would just rather get a text message. Hey, when are you available? Tell me when we can speak. Make it simple. Because, you know, you get 100, 150 emails a day to plow through it. That might be effective. It may not be effective. You got to be creative in data points that also spark their interest. It can't just be what you expect to get out of it as the seller, but what they would need in terms of valuable information. For example, provide them with content that you think is relevant, newsletters, articles that are out there. You know, you're having the gentleman from CNBC speak to these entrepreneurs. Anybody who knows CNBC has heard of The Prophet. That's instant credibility.
Right.
And that's what you're looking for, instant credibility as that trusted advisor. So keep a pulse of what's going on in the market. Share blogs, share information, share content, and make yourself a valuable trusted advisor.
So when you go into some of these organizations as a trusted advisor yourself, do you see some patterns? Like, do you see some of the same mistakes over and over? And I'm sure you have better social skills than this, but you want to just like roll your eyes and go, here we go again.
Here we go.
Yeah, well, I mean, are there some of those things that you just see over and over and over?
Well, you know, obviously you're dealing, you know, when you're working with, you know, the basic foundation of selling is finding who your coach is and who's going to be all of the folks in the decision-making process. And that's the toughest thing, is because you may have a great relationship with your coach. You may have a rah-rah entree to sell your solution or service. However, the CFO or the CIO is the one who's signing the check, right, and approving that contract. So if you're not on board with legal and all of the top C-level folks, you're probably going to be, you know, five steps behind where you think you are in the sales process. I mean, that's a tough act to follow, but you've got to make it feasible as well as very approachable to get in front of those folks.
Okay, so what's your backstory? How did you fall into this line of work, and how did you kind of land where you are now?
Well, I've been in biz dev and sales for a passion for it since the days after graduate school.
So you haven't had a real job the whole time. It's always been business development and sales.
No, it's always been APC, always be closing is what I was told, right? So, no, it's just I have a passion for it in terms of I like being in an advisory role. I like offering.
But you've done this for startups. You've been in large organizations. You've been in software. You've been in healthcare.
Sure.
I mean, so you really enjoy going in when they still don't have it.
Oh, yeah.
Quite figured out. Yeah?
Especially with, you know, with startups and it's a new solution or service. Right. I mean, we were one of the dot-com darlings in Atlanta many moons ago. We raised $54 million, and that was a great story. We had instant market share. Still had to work on the revenue piece of the model. But that, you learn lessons learned, right? Crowdfunding wasn't popular back then, but there were a lot of checks being written very quickly, right? But we did learn lessons learned. I mean, obviously, we were sold and had a nice story in terms of what the platform could deliver, but you got to be able to, you know, one of the hard lessons, I think, in software, and I'm sure Mike is exposed to that, is you got to get paid for the implementations as well. It's not just securing the deal. It's making sure the professional services and the consulting work that goes behind the customization, besides just selling the software, are all linked. And that's painful because, you know, most people don't budget for the extra professional services if it's not documented up front. So you've got to say, hey, you know, there's also an implementation price that we can budget at X dollars, might be more. What kind of customizations are we talking about? And that's a huge pitfall with software.
So do you find the startup world still, even at this point in your career, do you find it seductive? And like, even though you might go work over here and get a lot more, I mean, with your experience and background, I'm sure you could command some pretty healthy fees, but do you occasionally sort of just really get enamored with a startup and you're like, you know what, I'm going to throw in with these kids and see if we can't get something going? Do you ever do that?
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, you got to have your ears and eyes out there. Absolutely. We'll show up at the Kids Business Expo and see what Dirk's going to tell
you. I hope so.
What deals we're going
to
make
with these kids. Yeah, you might find a kid you're ready to invest in. Fantastic. All right, so what's next for you? Are you looking for your next opportunity in that regard? Are you, you know, neck deep in the middle of a project or two? Or
I'm actually in an advisory role for a startup now called Healthy Signs, but I am looking for other consulting engagements as we speak.
So you're actively looking for other consulting engagements?
Sure,
if only you could find people that needed the help.
Right.
Wow, it sounds
right.
To me like
no one needs sales help.
Well, now you can turn them on to an ROI tool, an expo, and some much needed money. Right.
Of course.
So Lee, you loaded his bullet belt.
So if somebody wants to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
hmedoff@gmail.com.
That's hmedoff@gmail.com.
You got it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.